This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shan Gallagher, and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Soyuz Bay, Dunedin, and I'm joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. You're a busy person last week. I got hold of you. Where was it? In Hamilton.
Oh, yep. I was away in the Waikato last week at a conference called Mio Mio, which is some work that I do as a researcher in the waste space, and in this instance I was on a panel talking about waste to energy. And it was interesting, Sam, because my position on waste to energy is, while unfortunately it's kind of necessary right now, we don't do it well. We're implementing strategies that have been used overseas and that are now being shut down because they're so environmentally damaging. We're putting them in really dumb places, like this big incinerator that is under resource consent at the moment to be installed on a floodplain in the Waikato, which is defies any logic, but, you know, we keep doing dumb things. But what was very interesting is when I said to everybody, please put your hand up if you make a conscious choice to put your batteries into landfill. So if you are not making a conscious choice to recycle your batteries, take them to any of the recycling places that take them, that means that you are consciously choosing to put them into landfill. So that was interesting. Yeah.
It's interesting when you put things in the perspective of what are you doing?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the big challenge, isn't it? Because so much of what we do in the sort of the environmental space, you can see that what we're doing is not changing systems, but expecting people to take that responsibility when it's actually the system that needs changing.
Yeah.
But it is useful sometimes to turn it around.
It is. And actually the system needs changing, and it will only change if the people demand it. So for me, like if I go to a store to buy a product and I've got the choice between one that is covered in a ridiculous amount of packaging and one that isn't, I will take the isn't one every time. Because I just refuse to be part of the problem. If I can buy a secondhand thing, I'll buy the secondhand thing. Because what's the point in making a product when there's a product that already exists? And you know, and if I can, and I look at how can I if when this product dies, how can I reuse it? How can I recycle it? And if I can't, then I have to think about, well, what's my other option? And we need more people to have that mindset, because it's only from that that we'll actually get the system to change. If we need to build a waste to energy plant to manage our waste, then we are doing something wrong. Because if you think about it, that waste to energy plant, quite a few million dollars to create it, so huge, significant investment, that is going to be a very hungry mouth to feed. As the person who funded it, or the people who funded it, are going to want a return on that investment. So we create this new system that we then have to feed with waste to justify its existence. And then what happens if we do actually get the kind of system change that we need, where people actually make a stand and there is a change to that? Are we going to start importing rubbish? Is that what to feed that hungry mouth? That's the next thing that goes wrong.
I've been obsessed in the last week by the notion of the Swedish law that if you're discharging into a river, you can do that so long as you're discharging upstream of your intake.
Yeah.
And the reason I like that, it might not even be real, but I don't care. It's the idea of it that matters.
Yeah.
The idea of it that matters is that if you change that, that completely changes how you think about what you're doing, your relationship with that river.
Absolutely.
And how you're processing things and what you're doing. And so the setting up a waste plant is kind of the opposite of that. It's reinforcing a current system rather than a system change.
That's right. And it's kind of in this instance, we know that the toxic smoke and all of the chemicals that are the byproduct of an incineration process. Yes, they're going to capture some of the carbon through filtering of the smoke, and then they're going to somehow encase that and then bury that. And all we're doing is just taking a problem and making it another problem. And putting it on a floodplain, and it's next to a kohangareo, it's next to a whariwananga, and it's next to Fonterra. And Fonterra are saying no, and yet it's likely going to go through. And it's on a floodplain. Like, there's just so many things that are wrong with it, and yet we're going to let it go through.
Because they can probably sell the idea of it, as an environmental thing.
Yes.
Because it's better than landfill.
Wow, is it though? That's the thing.
But that would be the story that could be told about it. This is a greener thing. Look, it's producing energy rather than just rotting.
Yeah, which is just horrendous. It really is horrendous.
I wonder if, similar to that Swedish law, I wonder if there's a thing that you could do in the conditions for it that would be a similar kind of game changer.
Mm.
That it wouldn't work to say you have to take in 10% less each year, because as you say, they've invested a lot in setting up this plant. So their goal is to maintain the waste flow.
Well, they want to increase the waste flow because the more waste there is. Oh, because there's also one being set up in Waimate. So there's one in the Waikato in Te Awamutu and one in Waimate. And they're both of them will be receiving waste from all over their respective islands. So it's not just the actual the toxic smoke that is going to cover the landscape. It's not just this constant waste. It's also the increased traffic that's on the road, moving waste from one place to another. All of the problems that go with all of that the whole idea is flawed. So we're just, again, taking a problem that we create. We import the problem in the first place because we generally don't make a lot of the stuff that goes to waste in New Zealand. So we another country creates a toxic space, creating a product, and then we ship it to New Zealand, and then we use it, and then we send it to waste, and then that's then taken away from our house and then taken to a whole other place where the problem is dealt with, well, converted to another problem. It's the whole thing is just problem on problem on problem on problem. We're not learning.
Is there what do we need to do to change that? Not maybe not the individual thing, but that not learning. For me, it's not, we're not taking the opportunities to look for system change.
No. So I've taken an opportunity to look for system change. So one of the things I came to from this conference that I was at last week was actually trying to get adults to change is really difficult. We know that. So what we need to do is make sure that our kids have a completely different approach and a different mindset to this, because they're the ones who are going to have to deal with these challenges. So where I've landed is that next year I'm going to lead an action research project that'll be completely designed and run by Rangatahi, and they'll publish their paper. So all I'm going to do is just be the facilitator for it and make sure that, you know, that they're learning the process of action research and referencing and themselves. But the idea is that this is 100% high school kids leading, conducting and submitting this research and writing up their findings. So And I think if we, the more we get the rangatahi voice, well, the more we enable their activism, the better chance we have of actually getting some proper system change. Because if kids can see the problem, then why can't their adults?
I'm going to talk more about that after we've played If by Bread.
Yeah, I love that song.
If a picture paints a thousand words, then why can't I paint you? The words will never show the you I've come to know. If a face could launch a thousand ships, then where am I to go? There's no
talking about engaging, enabling, I think is the word I'm looking for,
yep.
Rangatahi into not just research, but into activism. Do you think that those two things play nicely together?
Absolutely. I think that's why action research is so beautiful, because it fully enables the activist voice. It gives a structure, it ensures that proper processes are taken, and it enables the voice of rangatahi. It enables them to explore ideas they have of things, and to look at what change looks like.
And it gets people past the notion of science being memorizing facts.
That's right.
Science as a process, science as a, you know, the most important bit of science is raising those questions, is being able to articulate questions that you can then go and investigate.
Exactly. And so that it enables the voice of rangatahi. At the moment, I'm playing around with a methodology called photo voice, which it's quite new. I came across it when I was designing a research project for a project looking at how we can address issues with diabetes and heart disease by actually teaching people the nutritional value of what they're consuming. But if you ask people to write down in a diary, immediately there's a barrier. Well, there's two barriers. One is that people don't always know how to write or express things properly. And two, you just think, oh, yep, I'll do it later, and you never do. Whereas it's just real easy to whip out your phone and take a picture of every single thing that you eat in a day. And then in the research design, in the first couple of weeks, that each of those pictures will be assessed by a nutritionist who will say, okay, this is your calorie consumption for the day. You needed this much, but you consumed this much. And this is what that, you know, the nutritional value of that food looked like. This was how much sugar you had. This is how much good fat you had. This is how much bad fat you had. And then after that first couple of weeks of talking through the food, then we start teaching people how to do that assessment themselves. So it's usually using photos, photo voice, beautiful methodology, so easy and engaging. But looking at, you know, tools like that, that kind of fit into the way that our rangatahi approach life, enabling a different way for them to express themselves.
There's a similar approach in human-computer interaction called, I think it's called cultural probe, which is a very similar idea to that. And it's usually about giving somebody a different thing to interact with. But one of the ways that we've interpreted it is to, it was in the days of those disposable cameras.
Yeah.
And we had printed a wrap that you could put on the camera. And we had a checklist on the back of the camera of all of 24, I think it was, different photos that we wanted. So this was for the capstone projects, the final year projects that the IT students were doing. And so it was, the instructions were your project from a very different angle. How it started, what the client wanted, what they got. You know, it was a whole lot of quite different prompts that we put in. And we gave it to them, like they had this thing, they had the whole year to use this camera and ticking off this checklist of things. It was a great project. We ended up with a fantastic range of projects and different interpretations and different ways of looking at what they were doing that we would have never got to in 100 years of talking to them about, because we wouldn't have thought to ask that question.
Oh, that's so neat, eh? I love that. That's a beautiful form of ethnographic research in people's natural way of doing it and letting you see the world through their eyes without the need to necessarily write stuff down. So removing a huge barrier. I love that.
I've still got one of the wraps somewhere. I'll see if I can find it and send it to you.
I'd love to see that. That'd be real cool.
I suppose because you are really... And it's not citizen science, because citizen science usually means the scientists have come up with an idea and we're just like crowdsourcing some of the data collection. But you could say it's a much better version of citizen science, because you're actually like, what is the question we're asking here?
Yeah.
The whole process you're handing over and helping them with.
Exactly. So the whole point is for them as scientists in their own right, as student scientists, to actually create the question that what is the actual big question for them right now? What is the thing that really matters to them? And what's inspired it was, you know, I was at Jack's school and I was watched, because in the East of Plenty, almost all the schools have a school lunch now. That's just pretty standard across the Eastern Bay. But I was standing there watching the caretaker loading all of these recyclable, compostable food containers, some with food in them, into the waste management bin. And then he emptied the rubbish bins into the same bin. And then the kids were emptying their classroom bins into the same bin. And then I suddenly thought, there is nothing being recycled here. This is all going to landfill. And I was absolutely horrified because, you know, as you know, Jack's got his waste management column and blog where he's talking about how do we change our approaches to waste? How do we fix this problem that we have with waste? And here's my 13-year-old son whose activism is so strong in the space and his school's not even engaging properly in it. So that was the problem that I took to the conference, and I've come home with this plan for enabling rangatahi to be the researchers and to be active. Yeah, I love it. I'm so excited.
We shall have to try and have him on the show again.
That'd be neat.
We'll have to warm him up.
Yeah. He's pretty condemning of how terrible we, the adults, are. He's become, it's actually really, I mean, I think that this generation of kids is quite cynical anyway. This, what do we call them? Gen Alpha. The Gen A kids, they are quite cynical anyway, and for good reason. But this seems to have even more, it's deepened his cynicism, which is kind of sad in a sense, as he struggles with what he says is really, you know, straightforward, common sense decision making, and we constantly fail at it as the adults in the world that run things.
But he's mixing that cynicism with a we can actually make a difference.
Yeah,
it's not I'm not seeing a kind of a depressing cynicism. It's we can actually do stuff.
But he doesn't feel hopeful that the adults of the world can do anything, because his position is if you could have, you would have, and you haven't. So it's up to us. So we just need you actually to move out of the way so we can start fixing things. That's where he's landed now.
And he's busily raising money to go to space camp.
He is. He's just on his way to now. They've made these amazing little aquabots for the New Zealand aquabots nationals. So he's and that's using recycled materials. Their magnets for their aquabot came out of dead microwaves, things like that. So, and the copper wire came out of other dead machines. Like, they've just, you know, used heaps of recycled material, and I love that that's what they're doing. And so they've made these little aquabots that do these underwater jobs. And we put four teams into the Easter Bay of Plenty competition and came first, second and third. So then there was a massive panic to get all of a sudden 11 people down to Christchurch, and we had 6 weeks to get the money. And because, you know, in the Easter Bay of Plenty, one of the most impoverished places in the country. So it was a big challenge, but we managed to get 100% of the funding we needed. So I'm super thankful to, we got some money from Toi EDA, which is our local economic development agency. We got some money from McDiarmid Institute. And we got some money from Tupuni Kokiri. So we've managed to fund the whole trip. So no pressure on our families, which is amazing.
And that's not this weekend, the weekend after?
Yep, Thursday. We fly down Thursday afternoon next week, which is exciting. And then we're going to take the kids to the engineering department at Canterbury University. Hopefully, Henry, your son, is going to be there with us. So I've just been organising that. We're going to their mechatronics department and their design thinking department. And then on the Saturdays, our practice, and Sundays, the competition.
And that's in a swimming pool?
Yeah, big swimming pool. I can't remember where. I did know, but now I don't know. But we managed to get our flights through Air New Zealand really cheap. It was only $402 per person for a return trip straight from Tauranga to Christchurch and back, which is makes it easier. And we're staying at a university hostel because, of course, just as, you know, the students are leaving, we're rocking up. So that'll be perfect. So, yeah, it's going to – and some of these kids have never been on a plane, let alone to the South Island. This is, you know, this is such a big deal.
Yeah.
Like these are I remember how funny it was, Sam, being at this competition and Jack's team, three rangatahi Māori, these three boys just having the best time, just laughing and giggling and just enjoying themselves, not treating it like a competition at all. So when their name was called that they had come in third place, everyone just gasped, like, what? Those three little rat bags, but they just love it. They love their little robot called Ohini Mataroa, which is the proper name for the Whakatane River. That's what they've named their little aquabot. Their presentation is all in te reo, and they're just so proudly young Māori men having the time of their lives playing around with their aquabot. You know, it's just wonderful.
That's amazing.
It is.
We shall look forward to the report on that. And then he's going to space camp.
Yes, we're taking 30 kids to space camp. So we've got 30 kids, 21 so far confirmed. So that's 2025. I'm going to go to that as well as a parent help. So at the moment it's all sausage sizzles and rubbish collection, and I've been flat out making relishes and pickles and stuff for Jack for his fundraiser, which I thought, what can I do that I enjoy that he can participate in? So that's it. He's my chief chili chopper at the moment.
Where is the space camp?
In Houston.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, I think we go to Houston. No, I think we fly to Houston, and then where the actual space camp is, I don't know. But we go and sit in the room where they received the message, Houston, we have a problem. We actually go and sit in that room. Ooh. And so the kids do astronaut training.
That's so fun. That's such
going to be amazing.
That's such a great thing. And, I mean, the fact that they're going to do – I want to come back to the fact that they're going to do their presentation at Aquabots in Torreo.
Yeah. That's so cool,
those poor organizers.
but we're translating it, though, so we're going to make it so their presentation will be – Jack will say that everything in Māori, and then one of the other team members will say the same thing in English, so it'll be fully translated. But it's just this really important –
what a great challenge for the organizers.
So good, eh?
Yeah.
Even just to hear them say ohene mataroa.
Yeah.
that in itself. And all three, I think they are all – they're all going to say their pepeha. They're just such a clever, gosh, they're so clever, these boys. But I just love they're bringing everything about themselves to this. This is them bringing themselves to the competition.
But that's one of those system change things that we were talking about.
Yeah.
Them doing that means that those organisers will be having a meeting to figure out how they're going to manage that, to respect that and to enable that. They're going to be running around trying to find, is there somebody that in Christchurch, a Torreo speaker in robotics?
Yeah.
And that probably, that question wouldn't have come to them, wouldn't have occurred to them before.
No. And yet it should have, and it will always in the future. Because I would say, because given that Pāroa, which is our local Kura Kaupapa primary school, one of their teams is also going, because they came in the top three in the primary school competition. Theirs will all be in Māori as well. So you've got Jack's team all in Māori, 100% Māori team, and the same with the Pāroa school team as well. How cool is that, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's so, you know, Jack's fully supportive. I mean, he's getting really confident with his reo anyway, but, you know, he just sat down with his Māori teacher and he wrote it, she corrected it, and they're ready to go, and I just love it.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi araha nui kia koutou ko tāpahau. I hope you're all having a best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the time, the space, the love, the compassion, the kindness, the support that we also richly deserve and can innately give. I know for myself, of course, the living world is a huge comfort to me, and I'm so lucky with my role at Orokinui Eco Sanctuary that I am able to be in nature, in the living world, and with such lushness and such abundance, such fecundity, such beauty, and it really restores my heart. I'm so grateful. At the moment, I'm hoping very soon not to be testing positive for COVID, but I've had a very rough last 10 days with a terrible bout of COVID. So when I saw Harvey off to his arborism course this morning and then went and put the bin out, I was struck, of course, by the beautiful sunshine, the beautiful flowers swaying in the wind, and the beautiful song of the birds, and all of these flowers that are just springing up everywhere, and how different each one is, how miraculous each one is, how beautiful each one is, just like all of us. And because I was so sick with COVID, I couldn't go down for Harvey's arborism competition. which I was sad about, and he got second place, which was still very, very good. The whole of New Zealand, he's the second number two arborist. So I felt very proud of him. But of course I wished I had been there to support him. I did book us a very flash hotel, and when he was staying there, I didn't realise, but next to the hotel was a nightclub. And so he was kept awake until very early hours of the morning by this nightclub. And so the very fancy hotel, well, didn't really help him get much sleep, unfortunately. But there we are. I know now. And I know to check now when I'm booking these places. What's next door? So of course we are all learning all together all the time, and I feel so fortunate to be part of this show. It's taught me a huge amount, continues to teach me a huge amount. When people share their stories and when people share their hopes and their visions for the future, how beautiful it is that we can come together and do this for one another. And I'm hoping to be back at work tomorrow, and I'll have lovely Eco Warriors, lovely early childhood group, and lovely primary school group. And just imagining it now, have these waves of relief and happiness, you know, running through my body, because I'm just really looking forward to being out with them in the forest, seeing the takahe and their baby, seeing the beautiful kaka, hopefully seeing Waimarie the eel, certainly looking at all the pond creatures who live with her. But yes, I'm really looking forward to that, and it will be a great juxtaposition to having been in bed for the last 10 days. Very grog. So I'm really hoping for you that you have things that you're looking forward to, that you have these moments where you can appreciate the beauty of the world around you and the beauty of the world within you. These moments in the living world that are so transcendent and healing, so powerful and so affirming. I hope you're getting lots of those. I hope you're looking forward to some heart-restoring interactions, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
How's your swimming going, Sam?
It's going very well. I am ramping up the distances. Speaking to Adam, who my friend that swam the English Channel in about September, he's back in the harbour with me, and he scared me the other day by saying that we really should do the length of the harbour before Christmas. That's 22 k's. We're in the harbour, and we'd just done 3K, and it seemed like quite a long way. So 22 Ks before Christmas is seeming quite a long way. But if we want to, we both have our hearts set on doing the harbour both ways. We want to go down the harbour and then back again this summer.
That'd be amazing. You time it with the tide, eh?
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of points in the harbour where swimming against the tide is not a happening thing. And preferably the wind. If you get the wind, if you can get the tide to change perfectly as a southerly comes through, so you can surf back down, that would be perfect. It's unlikely to happen. And the harbour, it's an enclosed harbour, so it doesn't have much swell, but it does have a nasty chop.
Yeah.
And there's the chop gets nasty when the wind is against the tide.
Right.
So there's a couple of places on the harbour where you really almost can't swim against it into it. Because it's just such a nasty chop. Mm. But that's all right. We'll get there. I've got to go to India first.
When do you go to India?
On the 6th of December.
Oh, that's coming up. That's only 3 weeks away.
Yeah, so that's quite exciting. So that's talking about that's a keynote for a big computing education conference.
Yeah.
Where I'm combining all of the different streams of the work that I've been doing into one thing. So the title is Searching for Computing Soul. So it's taking a professional practice approach to computing. On the premise that if you ask a nurse what's the underlying value of nursing, they'd all talk about something along the lines of an ethic of care.
Mm.
If you And everything else is based on that. And if you look at the nursing competencies, all nurses have the same set of competencies with a bit of specialization. Okay. So that's a useful model to compare it to. If you ask computing people, what's the purpose of computing? You don't get a sensible answer. You certainly don't get a consistent answer. What you tend to get is a bit of giggling and saying, well, it's about making money. And then if they think about it a bit more, they'll say it's an enabler of systems or something like that. And my premise is that because we don't have that core equivalent to the ethic of care, then by default we accept the neoliberal.
Yes.
We accept that the purpose of computing is efficiency, is speed, is more productivity, which those things might be good, but there might be reasons why those things aren't good.
Absolutely.
And there might be things like, you know, Jack's Aquabot. They could probably build a better Aquabot if they didn't muck around using recycled materials, but that would defeat the purpose of what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And so there are similar sorts of things in productive computing. And because of that, it makes it really difficult to introduce things like sustainability and ethics and colonization, decolonization, because you're already fighting against this neoliberal thing, as which kind of we accept as the core principle. And so when we then try to talk about sustainability, we're on the back foot. We're having to argue against this amorphous blob that isn't actually defined, but is kind of accepted as the purpose of what we're doing. So I've got a PowerPoint to write sometime in the next week. That's my goal for the day, in fact, is to make that PowerPoint. I gave a guest lecture to 66 postgrad students for EIT the other day. They're actually based in Auckland on all this. And they said, at the end of that talk, they said, that's the talk I should give in India. So yeah. I might be beating myself up, making it too hard, because in that I go through what my take on sustainability is and how that applies to sustainable practice, and doing things like for me, the sustainable practitioner is not about a set of, here is this checklist of things, how you need to behave. It's these questions that you need to have thought through yourself. So having an understanding of things like, I think we've talked about before, we use the forester. We could certify a sustainable forestry program in which we identify the things that you should be doing to reduce your hand footprint and increase your handprint. And so then the challenge for any discipline is to say, well, what are those things in that discipline? So computing. So what are the things that computing could do to reduce its footprint? But that's not the answer, because that's just the easy bit.
Yeah.
The harder stuff comes on, what do you do on the first day of the job when you're told to stop mucking around in terms of the forester, stop mucking around recycling the oil, stop mucking around sharpening the teeth on the chainsaw, just stick a new set of teeth on, throw the others away. How do you respond when you're told to just get on with the job and stop mucking around doing the sustainable stuff? That's the skill. That's where the question is. And then on the second day of the job, you're told to chop down the last kauri tree. So you might have a bottom line that you said, I'm not going to chop down the last kauri tree. I'm not going to be that guy. But in order to do that, you need to have decided that. You need to know that that's important. You need to be looking. You need to be looking to see, oh, this isn't just any old tree. This is the last kauri tree. And then you need to have the response. What do you do? Because and if we have answers that are involving, you know, you need to have holistic catchment management principle, you know, all that sort of higher level stuff. Hang on, but a forestry qualification, somebody with holding onto a chainsaw, is like level 4. Or probably, you know, 3 or 4. It's not this where you can build in complex catchment management, forestry management systems. So that's the forestry case. So what does it look like when we think about it in terms of computing, for example? What's the bottom line that we're going to do? So I might say, I am not going to buy a computer that was made under slave-like conditions in Cambodia. I've seen those places, that's my bottom line. But then am I looking? Now, I don't actually buy computers, but I buy clothes. And so it's not just about computers. I might say I'm not going to buy any clothes that come from a slave shop in Cambodia. I know that I don't look.
Yeah.
I don't look. And when I buy clothes, I don't go and find out where these clothes are made and what conditions that they were made under. But so you have to be look. You have to know what you're doing. You have to look. And then you have to have the response about what you do about that. Because if you just say, no, I'm not doing that, they'll just get somebody else to chop the tree down.
That's right.
So how do we expect people to respond? I think those are the questions about what it means to be a sustainable practitioner.
Yeah.
So that's a that's a third of the talk that I've haven't written yet. That has to be written soonish, and then I'll borrow from the decolonization work, which is a similar set of sort of logical steps and logical sort of argument of understanding that the values of computing are the values of colonization, and how do we deal with that? Because there's lots of things. I mean, it's the same as the bigger decolonization argument. I don't think anybody's arguing that we remove all technology, we go back to 1830.
No, and, we can't go back.
Yeah, nobody's sensibly suggesting that. So we need to get past that. Okay, go back to the caves and we'll talk about decolonization. That's not the point. But how do we do that? Why is the curriculum for computing in India precisely the same as the curriculum for computing in California? Now, it could be that turns out to be, yep, we're happy with that. That actually works. But that question's not being asked.
No, and it should be asked because the problems are different. The problems that computing solves are different.
Yeah, and as we've talked about before, if you take a tikanga approach to what is AI, you actually come artificial intelligence. You actually come up with a much more interesting way of thinking about AI.
Exactly.
So it's not just that we're coming up with okay, what bits of AI do you want me to not teach so I can teach this other stuff? It actually makes it better.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm working on. I was speaking yesterday to the chair. Oh, and I'm this conference in 2 years' time is a biennial conference is almost certain to be in Botswana, and I'm chairing it.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be amazing.
Yeah. So that's
terrifying.
Yeah, so, and the goal of this particular conference is to move the focus of, so this is, ACM is essentially the World Computing Body, of course, it's heavily dominated by, people think that the A in ACM stands for American, it doesn't, it's association, but it might as well stand for American. And so lots of, all the sort of the research and stuff that's going on is very American and Northern Europe centric. And so the SIGSE, which is the Special Interest Group on Computer Science Education, has taken the really commendable step of saying one of their major conferences is going to be in the Global South. And so the pitch is not just we're bringing an American conference to locate it in here and it's going to be in a fancy hotel and we won't go outside the doors because that's pointless, but to actually engage the local communities they see it as the local computer science community. I see it as going much wider than that.
Hmm.
What do the people in Botswana hope to achieve through computing? What are we trying to do? And of course, it's not just Botswana, it's the other countries around it. So lots of the things that we're talking about in India are actually about setting up the next trip to do that.
That's going to be amazing.
Yeah. I kind of don't need it at this time of the year. But I think that the impact for it could be really, really quite, very large, because it's not just the impact for it on the local community. I mean, Hyderabad's a high tech city, so it's not like that we're going in and taking away the abacuses and here is this computing. So it's not that we're going in and introducing technology in that kind of colonial development way. But I think that the bigger impact is to change how ACM interacts with the rest of the world.
Hmm.
So rather than seeing computing as something which is done in San Jose, Silicon Valley, and all you other people need to adapt to that. If we can start to break the chink in that and start to recognize that it's different and don't keep imposing these models. And that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm hoping is one of those system change things, like the river in Sweden, like Jack speaking in Te Reo Māori at the Aquabots. I think those things make a real difference.
I think so too. And it's going to be an amazing thing to go and be in that space and look where the difference can be made. And then you said before how it was a hard time of year, but actually what a great way to start next year, with the learning that comes from all of that, the thinking that comes from that.
Let's play The Flaming Lips. I'm pretty sure this is called Yashimi Battles and the Pink Robots, but I can't quite read my writing. It might be called something completely different, but anyway, let's play it.
She's a black belt in karate. Working for the city. She has to discipline her body. Cause she knows that it's demanding.
Thank you.
do the standard outros all the time. Let's do something different. What are your aspirations for 2024, Sam?
Well, as we were just talking about, assuming this conference gets confirmed in Botswana, then I've got a trip to go there. And I think it's not just that trip. It's actually thinking through and working a lot in advance with people from there, computer science people from there, about what would be helpful. Because the worst thing that I'd like would want to do is to go there talking about various things, but one of them being decolonization and being a white person turning up from the kind of the global north, even though we're at the bottom, and imposing things. So getting my head around how to do that is a big part of my aspiration for next year, and the work that needs doing around that.
That's a really nice place to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's useful to start with that, you know, claiming that positionality, but then you actually need to make a change on the basis of that personal change on the basis of that position. You can't just say, I am a white guy, 50, whatever I am, 53, Cornwall and New Zealand, and now let me do all this colonial stuff. How we actually do, what's the implication of that, and actually taking it like seriously ourselves, yeah. I think that's a big challenge.
I think so too. But I just love that that's where you're at. You know, like if more non-Indigenous people had that approach to the country they call home, then we would start to see a lot of our social problems being sorted out around the world.
And another aspiration is I want to put on an art exhibition.
Oh, that's neat.
How's that for something completely random? I've been working with Ruth Myers on a series of papers for a computing journal, computers and society journal, where we are taking a diagram from my collection of sustainable diagrams. And she's an artist. And she is then engaging with that diagram in ways that for me are totally so left field and creative that I just wouldn't have occurred to me. Mostly for the first two, it involves her going to the beach. She lives right by the beach, and drawing pictures of rocks over and over and over again, or seaweed over and over and over again. And then we have a discussion about what can we take from that diagram for computing, and from her, not just the artworks, but the process for computing.
That's neat.
And it seems to be working, but what it's making me think about is that all of the work that I've been doing on alternative storytelling, I need to actually be doing it myself.
Yeah.
So I've got an idea along similar lines with those, engaging with those different diagrams of sustainable practice, because we've now got 900 of them, different ways of thinking about how to represent sustainable ideas. And I want to explore with my family representing those, not trying to say, okay, here is this diagram, let's reproduce it in wool or what it might be, but actually use those diagrams as a starting point to explore other things. Anyway, that is my aspiration.
That is a beautiful aspiration.
And what's yours?
I have too many, but I guess the big one is just to keep trying to be the best mum that I can be for Jack, to support him in his aspirations. Everything comes back to that.
I think you're doing an astounding job of that.
Thank you. I hope I can keep going with that, because it's joyful.
It's joyful to watch. Well, we've managed to do the longest intro in the history of blowing bubbles. Let's not have a guest today.
That was so good.
Well, can't you see that it's just raining? There ain't no need to go outside. But baby, you hardly even notice when I try to show you. Song is meant to keep you doing what you're supposed to. Waking up too early, maybe we could sleep. Make you banana pancakes, pretend like it's the weekend now. We could pretend it all the time. Can't you see that it's just raining? There ain't no need to go outside. But just maybe, like a ukulele, mama made a baby. Really don't mind the practice, cause you're my little lady. Lady, lady, love me, cause I love to lay you lazy. We could close the curtains, pretend like there's no world outside. Could pretend it all the time, Lord. And can't you see that it's just raining? There ain't no need to go outside. Ain't no need, ain't no need. Can't you see, can't you see? Rain all day and I don't mind. Telephone singing, ringing, it's too early, don't pick it up. We don't need to, we got everything we need right here, and everything we need is enough. Just so easy when the whole world fits inside of your arms. Do we really need to pay attention to the alarm? Wake up slow, wake up slow. Hardly even notice when I try to show you this. Song is meant to keep you from doing what you're supposed to. Waking up too early, maybe we could sleep. Make you banana pancakes, pretend like it's the weekend now. And we could pretend it all the time. And can't you see that it's just raining? There ain't no need to go outside. Ain't no need, ain't no need. Rain all day and I really, really, really don't mind. Can't you see, can't you see? You gotta wake up slow.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.